Hi, I'm Susie Burrell.
And I'm Leanne Ward.
And welcome to The Nutrition Couch, a weekly podcast from two of Australia's leading dietitians, bringing you everything that is new in the world of nutrition, diets, and good food. From The Nutrition Couch today, why Australians are eating a credit card-sized amount of plastic every year. Our weekly client discussion is on hunger. Are you really hungry when you're eating? We found a fantastic new plant protein-based soup option for you as we move into winter. And our listener question is all about macros. What are they and what do we need to know about it when it comes to our diets? But to kick us off this week, we wanted to say a really big thank you to all of our new subscribers, didn't we, Leanne?
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for all of your support. And we must say that even just listening to the podcast is a huge bonus for us. But what really affects the charts and more importantly, the Apple Nutrition charts, which Susie and I have debuted at number one, which we're very excited about, is actually your subscription. So if you can actually subscribe to our podcast, particularly if you have an iPhone, subscribe through the Purple Apple Podcast app, that really helps us to move up in the charts Australia-wide. So we very much appreciate your subscriptions, guys. Thank you very much.
And to lead in today, there was a really interesting story a couple of weeks ago in The Australian all about microplastics. Leanne, tell us about what we need to know about that.
Yeah, so I had a friend who said to me, do you know you're eating your credit card amount of plastics each year when you eat rice? And I was like, what? I love rice. I always eat rice. What's happening? So I did a little bit of research, Susie, and it actually came from the University of Queensland, which is where I did my master's degree up here in Queensland, obviously. And researchers found that, or it says in the article, Australian scientists have discovered rice can contain trace amounts of potentially harmful microplastics during a world first study published in the Journal of Hazardous Materials. Researchers at the University of Queensland detected an average 100-gram single serve of uncooked rice usually contains about 3 to 4 milligrams of plastic, but the amount of microplastics is 4 times higher in instant or pre-cooked rice with an average of 13 milligrams per 100 grams. So I guess this kind of makes sense, Susie, if we're reheating the rice in those plastic containers or in those microwavable bags, doesn't it?
Well, I first became aware of this idea of microplastics a couple of years ago when I was doing some work for a filtered water company. And that was one of their big messages, is that whenever people are drinking from plastic bottles, which even sometimes with our best of intentions, we do pick them up at the service station or occasionally are using them. And that really adds up over time. And so a closer look at the research showed, yes, we're seeing more microplastics found, for example, in placentas of babies, and without doubt, you know, we're consuming them via the food. Now, this is the first study I've seen in terms of rice, or specifically quick cook rice. And, you know, for all of us recommending healthier options, and often we might recommend a brown rice or a black rice that are heated in those pouches, mm-hmm. It's a little bit alarming because we, of course, think we're making a good choice and going for healthier options in convenient ways to prepare them. But this is absolutely going to make me think twice about recommending those and really considering the way we're cooking it, knowing now that these are leaching in. Now, we still don't know what the health consequences are of consuming microplastics. There's some hypotheses around disrupting certain hormonal pathways, potential impacts on fertility. But at this point in time, these are hypotheses only. None of this has been proven. But I guess it just doesn't feel quite right knowing that we're ingesting microplastics. And there's got to be some consequences, I would say, long term, particularly from my understanding, is when the plastics are coloured, because on top of the actual microplastics themselves, you've got the colours that are added to give them their bright packaging. So I think watch this space. It's a reminder to us that perhaps going back to some of the traditional cooking styles, you know, in a good old rice cooker, for example, perhaps is something we need to be considering a little bit more.
Couldn't agree more. And I've myself used those microwavable rice cups and packets. I recommend them for my clients. So when I saw this article, I was like, oh, but you're right. We shouldn't be causing fear or concern in people. And the article did specifically state that it's not a cause for concern. People should just be aware about it. And it really does come down to, I guess, a dose response relationship, right? If you're someone who eats microwavable rice twice a day, I think that's really important for you to decant that rice into a normal bowl or something like that. So it's not to say that we can't buy convenient things like microwavable rice, but just not microwaving it in the actual plastic cup or the bag. But as you mentioned, fresh is best, right? If we can cook it ourselves, I think that's probably the best option.
Going back to the natural methods, of course. But I think what we will also see, Leanne, is, you know, food manufacturers will not like to see that perhaps their unknowingly giving their consumers microplastics in their own packaging. So I suspect what will be happening right now is that the food technologists and packaging experts will really be taking a closer look at that. They'll be really testing and they'll be looking for more user-friendly packaging options to try and reduce that ingestion. And it really is a matter of watch this space in terms of not only understanding consumption, but potential health effects long-term. I think absolutely we'll be learning more about this microplastics concept in future years. And it's a good reminder to all of us on a daily basis when it comes to our water bottles, taking our water bottle with us is really, really important.
Absolutely. So you guys heard it here first on the Nutrition Couch. Watch your microwavable rice and your microplastic consumption.
All right. So moving on, the weekly client discussion was, it came to me talking to a client about hunger, and I had a look at a food diary that she had filled out for me. And I sort of looked at the timing and there was like something at 7 o'clock and then there was something at 9 o'clock and there was something at 11 o'clock. And I said to her, you know, this is a good intake in the sense that you're recording everything and you're having balanced meals. But I just want to ask you, do you remember feeling hungry for any of those? And she really took a step back and it just made me really think about there are so many reasons we all eat. We eat because there's tasty food available or someone else is eating, or it's a break time at work, it's an opportunity to eat. But really getting in touch with hunger is one of the simplest things we can all do to help regulate our intake better and get more in touch with that. So I thought it was a great topic for discussion and thinking, you know, how often does that come up for you when you're talking to your own clients?
Yeah, absolutely. And as you mentioned, it's one of the simplest things we can do when actually trying to lose weight or focus on a healthy lifestyle. Yet it's also one of the first things that people lose touch with when they begin a quote unquote diet or actually try to eat healthier, because a lot of people will count their calories, they'll put their macros into an app. And all that does is sort of switch off those signals from your body that tell you, oh, I'm hungry, it's time to eat. So I think somewhere between being a toddler and a child and adulthood, we lose touch with those sensations within our body that actually tell us that we're hungry, because you could never force a toddler to eat something. Even if you put a bowl of ice cream in front of them, they might have 2 or 3 spoons, they'll push it away and they say, "Mummy, I'm not hungry anymore. I don't want anymore." You cannot force a child to overeat. So somewhere between being children and growing up, we've sort of lost touch with that, haven't we, Susie? So as you said, it's one of the simplest ways to actually appreciate living a healthy lifestyle long-term is learning to tune back into our bodies, not eating because we're stressed or we're bored or we're procrastinating or we're working from home, but genuinely eating to nourish our body and provide our body with fuel and not nourish our emotions.
For me, the biggest thing with clients is that the way their daily food intake flows is that they tend to sort of eat, start the day light. They might grab a milk coffee, so that sort of depresses their hunger for a period of time. And then they might grab a healthy, you know, perceived healthy lunch, some sushi or some tuna salad. And then as the day progresses, because they haven't fueled adequately in the first half of the day, they get really hungry throughout the afternoon, and inevitably because of the flow of life where we're more likely to enjoy alcohol in the evening and have a larger dinner, particularly if we're eating out or ordering in, and then of course reward ourselves with food after dinner, sweet treats and programmed eating behavior as that, you know, reward after the end of a tough day. When you graph calorie intake, it naturally has a huge proportion being consumed in the second half of the day. You know, sometimes more than 60, 70% of overall calorie intake can be consumed after 5 or 6 p.m. Now, the issue with that, of course, is that we're going to bed, we're not overly active, our hormones at the second half of the day are programmed to store rather than burn. But of course, the other thing we don't talk about as much is that we don't tend to then wake up hungry. You know, 50 years ago, everyone had dinner at 6 o'clock sharp and there was no snacking after dinner. The range of snack foods just didn't even exist. So even if people had dessert, they might have had it by 7 in the evening. That still gave people naturally a 12-hour period without food overnight. I would very rarely see a client who would naturally have, with their intake at the moment, 12 hours without food overnight. You know, if they're eating, snacking 10, 11 o'clock, sometimes they have only not eaten for 8 hours. So they're not overly hungry in the morning. And so that is the other issue. And so when I'm trying to help someone kind of reset their metabolism and induce fat loss, what I want is for them to be hungry in the morning. So in some cases, I may try a fasting program where they might not eat until 10, 11 in the morning until they sort of reset that hunger and know what it feels like to be hungry in the morning, because that sets you up for success the entire day. But naturally what I find is that most people eat way too much at night, and then that is setting us off on the wrong foot for the remainder of the day.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I remember reading some interesting research a couple of months ago now around gut health, and the research is very emerging with fasting and gut health. And admittedly, it was still in animal studies. It hadn't yet translated to humans. So still very new, emerging, watch this space. But it was essentially saying that for good gut health, we should be having at least a 12-hour fast, which, as you mentioned, sounds like fasting, but actually should be normal. That should be normal, that we're just giving our body a break from food in order to allow our body to rest and digest and our gut health to do its thing. And a lot of people are experiencing irritable bowel and gut health symptoms because they're constantly snacking and grazing throughout the day and never giving their gut that time to rest. So yeah, I don't even think of it from a fasting perspective. I think of it just, you know, eat your normal meals when you're hungry and don't start eating the next day until you are hungry. And I love challenging my clients to actually hold off their breakfast until they are hungry, because so many people wake up and they just naturally eat the first thing and they hadn't even stopped to think if they're actually really hungry or not. So I think it's a really, it's a cool little challenge for all our listeners at home to, you know, some days you might wake up at 6 a.m. and be hungry and eat breakfast, and there's nothing wrong with that. Other days you might make it to 9 or 10 a.m. before you actually feel that true hunger sensation, and there's nothing wrong with either. What we know from the research is that the timing with fat loss doesn't necessarily matter, as long as you're in a calorie deficit for the entire day. So you don't have to wake up and eat breakfast first thing in the morning. It's no longer considered the quote unquote most important meal of the day. We've definitely debunked that myth over the last sort of 5 or 10 years. We understand that if you're hungry and you're a breakfast person, absolutely okay to eat it. If you're not, absolutely okay to skip it as well, as long as your first meal is a great nourishing sort of whole food based meal, not just a bag of lollies at midday or something like that.
No, I like that too. I when I see people eating at sort of 5 or 6 a.m., I often will say, you know, I like holding off a little bit, you know, move around the house a little bit, try and get that metabolic rate up until you do feel hungry. And another trick I like, as well as that breakfast hunger challenge, is I try and get clients more in touch with their body by rating the hunger. So like you said, rather than just eating because the food plan says eat at 10 o'clock roughly, actually rating the hunger and giving that sensation a more objective number. So you learn the difference between extreme over hunger to the point where you might be more prone to binge eating, eating at a good level of 7 or 8 out of 10, but making sure it's not slipping in when you're just 5 or 6 and dragging it out a little bit more. And the other thing I quite like is for people to have at least 3 hours in between meals. You know, if you're eating every couple of hours, unless you're an athlete or very lean or have a specific goal of gaining lean muscle, most of us should be able to go at least 3, if not 4 hours if the meal is well balanced. Mm-hmm. So that's the other thing. If you're finding that you're feeling hungry every couple of hours, I'd be a bit worried about that. I'd want to sort of have a closer look at why. Are you eating out of habit as opposed to hunger?
Absolutely. And it's very important to differentiate between an active athletic population and a very sedentary population who, you know, I would still consider you sedentary if you have a desk job and you do a 45-minute gym workout a couple of times a week. I think you're still actually considered sedentary. An active athletic population would be somebody who's like a personal trainer or a PE teacher at school, where you're up on your feet all day long, you're burning calories all day long. Then you actually go and do a physical hour or two workout that day as well. That is what we would probably consider an active population. Or you look at proper athletes who train generally morning and night, you know, they're doing 2 sessions a day, they're burning a ton of extra calories, and in between those sessions they're going to rehab, they're going to physio, they're going into the hydro pools, they're doing a lot of activity all throughout the day. It's very, very different from the typical office worker or such as myself, who sits in front of my computer and does all of my consultations online. I sit here for podcasts for hours on end. I do a lot of my captions and work for companies from my desk and my computer as well. I probably sit on my butt for 10 to 12 hours during my workday, and I tend to go for a walk for half an hour to 60 minutes a day, plus a gym session. I still probably wouldn't consider myself active, because at the end of a workday, I'm lucky if I was to reach 3,000 steps, which is kind of sad in this day and age, Susie.
I think we could have a whole podcast on this very topic, because I agree 100%. And I'm not even going to reply, because I've got so much to say and I think it'll take us off track of what else we want to talk about. But I'm going to mark this, because I think it's a whole segment about, you know, the difference between the basic amount of activity that we need to do just to be healthy, and then looking at sort of activity and exercise on top of that. So watch this space. We will bring that up again very soon on the Nutrition Couch. But but on to perhaps more exciting things. We like the new product section every week. It's most popular segment, I'm hastened to say. And tell us about the new plant protein soups that you sent me quite a few weeks ago, and I was quite interested to hear more about them.
Yeah, of course. And just for our listeners at home, if you are interested in us continuing the conversation around physical activity and exercise and fat loss, please let us know on our social media pages. Head to Instagram. We're at the_nutrition_pouch_podcast, or just head to Susie and my Instagram pages and you can link us from there and follow us from there, and let us know if you're enjoying the conversation and what you would like to hear more of, because this really is it's your podcast. It's a listener's podcast. We want to know what you're loving and what you want us to chat more about. But onto our product of the week, Susie, Heinz Plant Protein Soup. It was raining in Brisbane one day. Admittedly, it rarely ever gets cold, but I'm a little bit of a cold frog and I felt a bit cool and I thought, oh, I'd love some soup for lunch with some fresh sourdough, Susie. So off to the shops I went, didn't have time to cook anything, went into the soup aisle and these were staring at me. They were on sale and I was like, fabulous, grabbed one in every kind. And I must say, I'm quite impressed, not just with the flavor, but also with the macronutrient profile as well of these soups. Lots of vegetables, 33% vegetables in the soup. If we're counting plant points for our gut health, we've got carrots, onions, sweet potato, roasted eggplant, chilies, lentils, pea protein. We've got ginger. We've got garlic. I'm up to 9 already in terms of plant points. And we only aim for 30 a week. So that's fabulous itself, Susie. Per serving, just over 1,000 kilojoules, which is what, maybe 250 calories. And that's for the entire pouch of soup. You don't have to do anything crazy like split the pouch in half. So quite a low calorie meal with 17.2 grams of protein for the pouch, which I think is fabulous from a plant protein perspective, because the soup is actually completely vegan or completely plant-based. 29 grams of carbs per serving and 5.6 grams of dietary fiber, which I actually think is a really good source of fiber, or what we might consider high fiber. So I actually think overall, Susie, this is a wonderful option in terms of soups. The only little thing that I would add is that the sodium content is quite high, 910 milligrams for the serving. But, you know, that's to be expected in a soup, isn't it?
It is. And you're absolutely right to say that, first of all, trying to get decent protein amounts in vegetarian and vegan diets is really challenging, because as a reference point, where I aim for about 20 grams of protein minimum per meal, that's a number I know that will help to buffer the carbohydrate load, keep people full for a couple of hours after eating. And of course, we love the vegetable and fiber bulk. Now, we do get asked a lot about sodium in soups. And of course, the recommended upper daily intake of sodium is 2000 milligrams per day. So that's almost coming in at half, and people might be a little bit concerned about that. But let's be honest, Leanne, like when we're having soup that tastes half decent, we go pretty heavy on the salt. If you've, you know, cook a soup and you don't season it, it's pretty bland. So the thing to keep in mind with soup is that because there's so much vegetable in it and also fluid load, the potassium is quite significant, and that really helps to buffer the amount of sodium in a soup. So yes, ideally I try and find soups that have got 600 to 800 milligrams of sodium per serve. So this is a tad over that at 900. But when it's so rich in vegetables and ticking so many other strong nutritional boxes, I wouldn't actually overly be worried. As a reference point, if you have a fast food meal, or if you have a tablespoon of soy sauce in your cooking, you're getting 2,000 milligrams in that. So it's not like we don't consume it. We consume it across a range of foods. And so in the grand scheme of things, some extra sodium in a vegetable soup is no cause for concern, because it will help to buffer it out. And it's still a really, really nutritious product. And I really like its one serve, because, you know, if you open one of those pouches, it's as if you're splitting it over two. People don't do that.
It's like a bag of vegetable chips or something. I had some the other day and it was like 5.2 servings per packet. I'm like, I could inhale this entire packet right now. There is no way that this would feed 5.2 servings. So
yeah, I don't think manufacturers purposely kind of do it. They're just trying to keep the numbers under control. But I think in this instance, you don't have to worry. But the other thing I always think, I've got a great vegetable soup recipe that I use, but when I actually count the cost of the ingredients, because it's got things like kale and celery and leek, now they can be quite expensive. And if you buy a really good quality stock, like a bone broth-based stock, that can cost $5, $7 a packet. Sometimes the soup will cost more than, you know, close to $30 to make. And sure, you get several serves, but from a cost perspective, these latest pouch and fresh soups you're finding in supermarkets with heavy vegetable bases, I really can't fault them nutritionally. And what did you say it was? Like $3.
Yeah, I got them on sale. I think I got them 20 or 30% off. So I grab one of every flavor. I've tried 3 of them so far and they're fabulous. My favorite one's the lentil roasted sweet potato dal with ginger and turmeric, which I think is just delicious. I had it with a piece of fresh sourdough. They're $4.50 at Woolworths full price, but if you know they do come on sale, they're definitely things to stock up your pantry with. I really recommend them. They're very tasty.
And I like clients to have a serve of soups or salad or vegetables with both lunch and dinner. So you could literally have that as well as a wrap or as well as some crackers or like you said, a slice of sourdough with some tuna or salmon on it. Or it's a great light dinner if you've overdone things and you're just looking for a low calorie meal to heat up on a Sunday night. But I'm a big fan and I think you really can't go wrong with a vegetable-based rich soup and don't feel any guilt if you're buying them pre-made. The ones that you can find in supermarkets are really strong and even more so for any vegetarian and vegan listeners, these are a really good choice for you because it's hard. You'll be hard-pressed to find 17 grams of protein in other soups out there actually. I don't think we had sort of reflected on that, but I think on average soups may have 8-10 grams maximum at the moment. So these coming in at 17 and close to 20 per serve really stand out in the category.
Yeah, particularly for plant-based. Absolutely. So that is our plant protein product of the week, Susie. What about our listener questions for the week?
And just to say, we'll also put a picture of that on our Instagram and Facebook page so you can track it down yourself. And we would love to know how you go with it if you give it a try. So let us know which one's your favorite. I think Leanne said her favorite was the turmeric one. So we hear what you think about it. But yes, our listener question of the week. Now, this came via Instagram. We've been getting some great questions and I have taken photos of all of them. So they will come up. So keep listening. But this was an interesting one. I had a little chuckle to myself because when we talk dietitian, we often talk about macros. And I did think we probably need to explain that a little bit because the question was, what are macros? What do I need to know about them? So I'm going to try and explain it as simply as I can. And Leanne, chime in at any point. Macros is short for macronutrient. And so when we're looking at different foods, any amount of calories is made up of the key macronutrients being carbohydrate, protein, and fat. Alcohol is actually also a fourth macronutrient, but that tends to stand in a separate category. It doesn't tend to slip into regular food or at all. So most foods we eat are mixes of those macronutrients. So bread, for example, is mostly carbohydrate, a little bit of protein, a little bit of fat. Something like a piece of fruit is all carbohydrate. Something like a piece of meat is mostly protein, fat, and water. So it's the combination of these different macros that give the overall macronutrient amounts of that individual food and combine to give the macronutrient profile of the diet. So when dietitians are doing their magic with their numbers, similar to the way a tax accountant would calculate your GST and do your BAS statements, in the background, we're generally calculating macronutrients because we know that adjusting the total amount of carbohydrate and fat and protein in our clients eat will affect their fat loss and weight loss goals or even muscle gain goals if that's the goal. So for example, the average person eats a diet that's about 60% carbohydrate, about 20% protein, 20% fat. And then if we want to induce some slow, sustainable fat loss, we might reduce that carbohydrate down to about 40%. And we will choose foods based on getting those ratios right. So it's not something that individuals necessarily need to understand. It's more the numbers that we're doing in the background. But if people are interested in it, and indeed some people, particularly those who are interested in activity and training in the gym or having specific muscle gain goals, they may also have a look at their macros in monitoring programs like MyFitnessPal, which will give you your own breakdown so you can sort of fiddle your own diet. So it's a general concept, and if you're particularly interested in nutrition or not getting to where you want to be with your food, you can have a closer look at that. But like any area, it's a little bit complicated, so sometimes you might have to have someone to interpret it. I had a client today, and she said, I'm really trying to get 20 grams of protein, and I'm weighing all my food, and it's such a small amount, just 20 grams. And I said, no, 20 grams is the percentage of a larger portion. So for example, in 100 grams of meat, there's 20 grams of protein roughly. So it can be a little bit complicated. So you don't have to know too much about it. It's a general concept. But I don't know, what do you teach your clients about macros, Leanne?
Honestly, we don't go too much into it. I think a lot of people have a rough understanding of which foods contain proteins, which foods are more fat-based, which ones are more carb-based. And I think having that general nutrition knowledge is important. I know there is a big push on social media for everyone to, you know, track their macros. And if it fits my macros, the big trend online that a lot of the bodybuilders and athletes are doing. And I guess it does suit the more athletic population. If that's something that you want to do is input your food into an app every single day for the rest of your life. If that's what you choose to do, you'd be my guest. But for a lot of people, it's not sustainable, but it can be helpful in terms of teaching them knowledge, absolutely, because a lot of people don't understand the energy density of things like fats, for example. If you're just going to snack on a cup of nuts every single day, I think you're going to have a hard time achieving your goals. If you're going to have a huge salmon fillet for dinner, and you're going to coat it in pesto and drizzle olive oil all over it, it makes it very difficult to stick to a calorie deficit. So think about it this way. Calories are king when it comes to fat loss. Macronutrients are queen. So you will not lose fat unless you're in a calorie deficit. Where macronutrients become important are in terms of, you can be in a calorie deficit and feel two different ways from a whole different range of foods. You can feel quite satisfied and full if you're focusing on whole foods and you have higher amounts of proteins and fiber within your macronutrient split, or you can feel very hungry and need more and more and more food if the majority of your macronutrient split is, you know, refined carbohydrates, for example, and very, very minimal protein, because protein as a macronutrient is very satiating. And it also takes the body a little bit more energy to break down protein than it does our other two macronutrients. So the thermic effect of food is something that really contributes for fat loss as well. So getting a little bit more sciencey here, Susie, but some people do have that general interest in understanding a little bit more about macronutrients. So it really does help in terms of that fullness and satisfaction that we feel with our meals if we can boost the protein a little bit higher in our diet. And we have mentioned how important protein is before for fat loss. But again, people like to take that message and just blow it out of proportion. Like, I've had some people DM me on Instagram, Susie, saying, you know, I'm having a hard time getting to 170 grams of protein a day. And I'm like, oh, well, how do you need 170 grams of protein? Because, you know, some PTs whacked up that you should be having 2.5 or 3 grams of protein per kilo of body weight, not adjusting for somebody who might be in a much larger body. We don't use that, you know, somebody who's quite overweight, that exact weight, and compare that against a protein number, put it that way. So there are many, many very different variables, I think, but it is important to understand the macronutrient split of foods. But if it is confusing or overwhelming for you, I would just encourage you to aim for what we call our perfect plate, Susie. Half a plate of salad and veggies, about a quarter of a plate of protein, and a quarter of a plate of carbohydrates. For the general population and the most, you know, Aussies, Americans out there, that's enough. That's a satisfying meal if you're doing that for lunch and dinner most meals, without having to count your calories, without having to input your food or weigh it all, that sort of thing. You just need to have that basic understanding of what's mostly a carbohydrate, what's mostly a protein, and what is a small fat serve and my veggies and salad to add to my plate.
100%. And I think where so many of us go wrong is that that plate doesn't have the half plate of salad and veg, because then if you don't fill your plate with sort of the watery salads and vegetables, automatically you have more protein. So a bigger piece of meat or chicken or fish, and then you have more rice or pasta to fill the plate. So the proportions make it a lot easier. And the only times I'll really get clients to look at macros are for two reasons. One, if they're not getting anywhere near enough protein at meals, like you talked about, so they might only be getting 5 or 10 grams at breakfast and lunch, and I want them to sort of start to pay more attention to choices that have more protein. So if they put ham in their sandwich versus tuna, there's going to be a lot more in tuna. So I want them just to skew their choices to higher protein options. Or, for example, I've got a client who constantly munches on carbohydrates, and she wasn't understanding why it wasn't working her plan, because she was feeling she was making healthy choices. So again, I just wanted her to become more aware that in foods like rice and rice crackers, there was a lot more fuel than I needed her to have because she had insulin resistance. So I'll use it sometimes as an education tool, but definitely not one for compliance, because I see that as something that we know and try and share with our clients in user-friendly ways, like the plate model or a little bit of counting, as opposed to everyone needing to know it. But again, if you're interested, absolutely, you can definitely get a lot of information on those sort of MyFitnessPal apps, which go into it in a lot more detail.
Absolutely.
So just as we wrap up this week's episode, you've had a big move and you have been a little bit obsessed with something different. What's been going on in the Brisbane life of Leanne?
Yeah, we found a new gym this week because we moved out of the house we had. We sold that. We're living with family at the moment while we think about renovating our new house, and we've discovered a new gym. It's brand new. It's snazzy. It's wonderful. There's a World's Gym around the corner, and for anyone who's into their fitness, you'd understand in Australia that World's Gym is the big one, or the bodybuilders go there. It's very like on scene, very trendy to be there. And my husband and I were like, yeah, we're not going there. We drove past it. You couldn't even get a park. It was like 6 p.m. There were literally cars lined up down the street. I've never seen anything like it. And we're like, ah. And we saw this new gym around the corner and we went to try it out. It was all of this equipment. There's barely anybody there. Everything's brand new. It's fancy. It was wonderful. So I just thought, you know what? I just love like a fresh training scene. So if you're a listener at home and the training that you're doing, it's not exciting you anymore, you're not getting results anymore, you're not bouncing out of bed really excited to go and get your exercise done, change it up a bit. You know, too often we go through these training things and we're still doing the same type of training 3 years later and we're no longer excited by it. We're no longer making gains. We're no longer making progress with it. It feels like a chore versus something that's really exciting. Just something as simple as switching gyms or getting a new exercise buddy or trying something new. Like I remember a couple of years ago, I did boxing for about 6 months, Susie, and I absolutely loved it. Just any type of exercise or movement for your body is going to be positive. So really encourage our listeners to go and try something new, particularly if you're no longer excited or inspired by the type of exercise that you're doing.
Yeah, I like that because change is always the key to keeping on top of metabolism as well. The body is so smart, it gets used to whatever we do so quickly. But I was surprised to hear today you sit down so much, 10, 12 hours. I never would have thought that.
Yeah, I do long work days. I'm a bit of a workaholic, but I do a lot of walking. So everyone always says to me, oh, you work out twice a day. But I'm like, no, the hour walk that I do isn't a workout. That should be what I'm naturally getting in throughout the day, but
so
I'm
how
not
many steps do you get on a normal day?
I average 10,000 a week. Like some days I'm at 15, other days like today, 4,500. I've been to the gym, but I haven't headed out for a walk yet. I'm going to try and get one in after this podcast. But for me, like when I used to work at the hospital, I worked in one of the surgical wards. The dietitian office was the bottom floor. Surgical was level 5. I took the stairs everywhere. I would easily get 10, 12,000 steps by the end of my day. I used to run down from the ward to the kitchen to the office, back up, grab some products, back up to the ward to see clients. I didn't have a problem. I didn't even need to go to the gym some days. I'm like, I'm so tired from running around all day versus my desk job now, which I absolutely love. Don't get me wrong, but I don't, you know, I'm not working in an office space. I can't wander around. I can't go see clients up on the ward. Everything I do is virtually online. I don't move half the time. I move from my desk to the kitchen to the bathroom, and that's about it most of the day. So my workout is to maintain and build my muscle mass, which is great metabolically, and my steps are just things I simply should be getting in during the day. But due to my circumstances now, I'm not. So I don't consider it an extra workout. I just, yeah, it's good for my stress levels walking, and I get some vitamin D as well.
A good time to listen to podcasts.
Absolutely. Just like the Nutrition Couch.
That brings us to the end of the Nutrition Couch today. If you have not done so already, don't forget to subscribe and have us delivered to your inbox each Sunday morning to set you up for a fit and healthy week. And we would love it if you could leave us a review. Don't forget, we also have our Instagram and Facebook pages at the Nutrition Couch Podcast. And you can leave any feedback or questions you have, and we will look forward to interacting and seeing you on board there. So we'll see you same time, same place next Sunday. Have a good week, and thanks for listening.
Catch you next week.